I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the Cartoon Saluniverse, the podcast that goes to a galaxy far, far away with one of the world's greatest animation studios, Cartoon Saloon. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm feeling the force.
So join us on our visionary quest into the glorious world of Cartoon Saloon. Jake, we're back. We're back. Charting the constellations of the Cartoon Saluniverse.
Drinking that sweet blue milk.
It sounds like we're dropping lots of references here to one of the great franchises of all time.
Yeah. Is this the closest we'll ever get to doing a Star Wars episode? Probably, really. I don't think we can handle getting abuse from Star Wars fans if we ever went fully into the franchise.
Well, I mean, you say the closest we'll ever get to doing a Star Wars episode. We are literally doing an episode about Star Wars, mm-hmm. Star Wars Visions, the TV series, which has the amazing conceit of letting great animation studios the world over loose on the mythos and iconography of Star Wars. The first series premiered a couple of years ago, and that was where Japanese animation studios had a crack at it. And then the second series, which launched earlier this year, was animation studios from around the world, including some of the great names that very much piqued our interest, including Cartoon Saloon. And as some listeners reminded us, we did say during our Cartoon Saluniverse miniseries a couple of years ago, when we went through the history of the studio, through their feature film and short film and some of their TV work, we did say, I'd forgotten this, wouldn't it be great if the imagination, the visual imagination of Cartoon Saloon was let loose on Star Wars? Do you remember what we said?
I genuinely can't.
Well, we agree with ourselves, yeah. Even if we can't remember.
Well done, us. But that word got out to Cartoon Saloon themselves, as we found out. Just that.
Yes, we can take full responsibility, I'm sure, for the fact that Cartoon Saloon have made one episode called Screech's Reach in the Star Wars Visions series that's now on Disney Plus. And really, it is, I mean, if not the standout, one of the standouts in a very strong crop of animated shorts. And what's amazing is Visions does allow the studios to imprint their personalities, their visual identities, their cultural sensibilities onto these shorts. So Screech's Reach is very much a Cartoon Saloon Star Wars short, isn't it?
Yeah, the style has not been diluted in the slightest. And, I mean, we're going to have a chat all about it. We get deep into it with Paul Young, the director, in just a moment. But I say this thing is short. So if you've got Disney Plus and you've got a spare, 14 minutes, right, go and whack it on and then come back to the podcast, because we do talk about plot elements of it with Paul. But right, you just want to really drink this thing in, because it looks absolutely incredible.
Absolutely. And watch it on the biggest screen available in your house, because there are, gosh, some of the big wide landscape shots, the production design, it's so wonderful seeing this. And also so interesting, the tone and the direction of the story, because it's a ghost story almost, or a creepy bit of folklore,
and also
explored.
A kind of evil origin story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this actually the best evil origin story in the Star Wars franchise? Does this do more in 14 minutes than three films did in the early 2000s?
Jake, you said we were avoiding fan controversy by not doing a Star Wars episode.
Okay, I probably shouldn't say that The Last Jedi is actually the best Star Wars film. I'll make sure I don't say that.
So, Jake, who shot first? Was it Han or Greedo?
Let's say Last Jedi is the best. And actually, Jedi Rocks is a really important scene, and I'm glad it exists.
Okay, wow. Okay, before we get, you know, thrown in a trash compactor as a podcast, we should move on to the actual topic of today's episode, which is an interview with Paul Young. As you said, Jake, Paul directed this short, but even though that's his first directorial credit at Cartoon Saloon, it's not, by far, not his first bit of work with Cartoon Saloon. He's been there from day one. We mentioned him a lot in the context sections of every episode of our Cartoon Saloon-iverse miniseries. He was one of the founding members of the studio, but where Tom Moore and Nora Toomey went more in the directorial direction, he became the producer, the CEO, the man who answered the phone and set up the deals that made Cartoon Saloon into the studio that it is today. A very important perspective that we've not heard from yet on the podcast. So when this happened, we really jumped at the opportunity to speak with Paul, not just about Screech's Reach, the development process, working with Lucasfilm, the tone and story and everything that went into making the short, but also hearing about his side of the Cartoon Saloon story and then the rise of the studio over the last 20-something years and then the future of the studio, what's to come.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a fascinating chat. Just to have the both sides of this from a kind of creative point of view as the director, but his producing hat on, like getting the insights from a business point of view of that journey was absolutely fascinating because he's great chat. And like we had a lovely time with an hour with him there. And I can see why if you happen to meet him at a film festival and he's flashing his business cards, I would very happily go and have a chat with him. I'm sure he could sell me on a film. I don't have much money to offer him, but if you want to get a Ghibli Tech co-production going, we can maybe stretch to 50 quid.
An animated short of us making a podcast in Cartoon Saloon style. Jake, I like the way you're thinking. But yes, without further ado, let's listen to our chat with the very wonderful Paul Young.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure. We're huge fans of Cartoon Saloon. Thank you for joining us. To start with, we're also huge Star Wars fans. So when the word first came around that Cartoon Saloon were going to be making a short film within the Star Wars universe, we were so excited. And I guess to start with, how did you first hear of this? What was the first engagement with Lucasfilm on the Visions project?
Thanks. A pleasure to be on the podcast, Jake and Michael. I have listened to those podcasts that you've done about it. I was like smiling to myself while I was gardening in my mother-in-law's. I started, Tom was saying, oh, you must check it out. The Bibliotech guys are talking about us now. So I listened to some, and I think, I don't know whether it was you guys, you might have speculated, oh, what if they did a Star Wars? But anyway, so it was basically after a long time. I've been producing for as long as the company's been going, and it never really was, I never really had the plan always to be producing. I often joke that because I was the one who sat beside the phone in the studio when we started, I became the producer just by default because I was answering the phone. But I liked it. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the travel. But Tom and Nora had been at me for a while now to look, the company sort of set up, we're pretty stable, and maybe you should get back to doing what you've always wanted to do, which is directing. And we all were in the same college together, so it was always my ambition to do that. But I've always been a partner with them as a producer. So they encouraged me. And just while I was thinking this, and actually I was thinking to myself, gosh, wouldn't it be cool if Cartoon Saloon did a science fiction? I kind of wanted to do like Cartoon Saloon's version of like an anime or something, but like a Mangok, as I was, I was kind of calling it for the crack, like a Gaelic. But I'm a very big science fiction fan. And so I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool now? That might be interesting if we did something completely different and did, worked in the sci-fi genre. And I was coming up with I was trying to think of a story to do. And then actually Jackie Lopez, one of the producers at Lucasfilm, just reached out for a call. And on the call, she just says, look, would you like to do a Star Wars? And I was just, funnily enough, I was just thinking about what I might be doing next. And I says, I would love to do it. And she was like, that's great. So it was very easy. It wasn't, I did play a little hard to get by saying, would we be allowed to do the post-production in Skywalker Ranch? And she says, yep. So I went, okay. So that was, no, but obviously it was like, it was great timing. And I was delighted, we were delighted to be asked. And, you know, we're not known for sort of doing, we have adapted things, and we were getting to the point where it's all our own original IP. So the idea of doing a franchise thing like this, we did have to talk about it and say, okay, how will it be perceived? And I mean, if you're going to do any franchise, Star Wars is a great one, because in itself, it's its own mythology, you know? It's like we've tackled mythology, and Star Wars is basically its own mythology, but in a galaxy far, far away. So that way, it just was a great opportunity. And a great opportunity for me to kind of do something very interesting. Yeah. And the great thing was they gave us a lot of freedom, which was also a big plus. It was really about, they want to have Cartoon Saloon do a Star Wars version, like a vision of it. So we were allowed to be ourselves. So that was the main. So it was a hard to say. Easy, yes.
And the brief, like, was it just like blank page, you guys know what you're doing, come up with something and we'll take a look at it? Or was there anything on there that they handed over to you that needs to tick these boxes or anything?
No real brief, apart from we'd encourage you to draw from your own culture, whatever you want. They knew we do that anyway, in a way, in past movies. But like, basically, no, it's supposed to be what interpretations of the Star Wars universe, almost to the point where it could be a parallel Star Wars universe. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if you see the first season, which I saw, you're going like, oh yeah, this is Star Wars, but it's like Japanese Star Wars, or it's like, maybe it's a multi-dimensional Star Wars. You know, it's kind of that interesting that you didn't have to worry about canon. So you have that lovely freedom to play with the kind of ideas of Star Wars and the kind of universe or the galaxy it's in, and tell a small or interesting story that's set in a corner of the universe somewhere. The only thing they were great. I mean, it was Jackie Lopez, James Waugh, and Flannery. There was a few great producers there, and Josh and Flannery, who helped us. Their kind of notes were always very minimal, but like, this would help this. Like, it was only if we ever were veering too away from Star Wars, which I don't think we did. They were just saying, but we'll keep you on track. And they were saying, no, this is all good. And then when it came to like maybe design, it was kind of, we did get a design pack that there was, I think, no zippers, no buttons. Mm-hmm. Which I think has been jettisoned now from past movies. But so that was it. They're very good producers because they're very comfortable. They know Star Wars themselves. We were dealing with the animation people. They were just very open to all the studios doing whatever they liked, really, and pushing it. As long as we pitched them two ideas. And I think we all liked the one we went with. We had two different ideas. And so we just thought Screecher's Reach had the best kind of twist to it. Mm. Most interesting. For a short, you know.
Yeah, and that's what's so exciting about Visions as a project, is that sense of freedom and expression and playing around with that mythology and mythos and the world without being too stringent to canon. When you're given that freedom, how did you settle on what you wanted to achieve with this short?
Well, I just basically teamed up with Jason Tamamagi and Will Collins, and we just huddled together, and okay, lads, I just said to them, they were like delighted. They are probably, I'd say, even bigger Star Wars fans than I was, and I was a Star Wars fan, but Will and Jason are really big fans, and had way more toys than I did, Star Wars toys. I see that as a kind of barometer. I have a Rancor monster and a few speeders and a few characters, which I used to mix up with other toys as a kid. They were purists. They have, you know, when you're a kid, you might play with different action figures and you'd mix up the worlds. That's what I was like, Action Force and Star Wars. And whereas they were purists, sort of Star Wars people. But anyway, so we just huddled and says, okay, let's come up with some ideas. And I was trying to come up with an idea about what would it be like if you were a kid with powers, but you'd no idea about Jedi or Sith or anything like that. You might be considered like a witch by your people. And what if somebody came down and rescued you? Like a Jedi came down and rescued you from these people who thought you were like abominable or something, right? So, and then Will had this interesting idea about Queen Maeve's grave, which is in Sligo here in Ireland, where this legend is, and I knew this myself when we were talking about it, of like you put the people go up to the top of the mountain and put stones on the grave to keep this woman down, Queen Maeve's, because she was supposedly such a bad woman. I mean, that's part of the stories, and I don't know how much of these are really true, but like it's almost like you put a stone on the grave so they stay down. So we thought, oh, it might be interesting if there was a character that had to stay down. So that was one other idea. And then Jason, though, did have the best idea, because his idea was great. Where he came fully formed one evening after having a sleep, and he woke up and says, I have quite a good idea, I think, about what if the cave of, you know, like the cave of evil and empire, what if it wasn't just an act? It turned out it wasn't just a test of the mind. So we played on this thing of the dark places that are kind of test your dark shadow of yourself as Luke Skywalker walks in there and faces his fears. What if it actually was physically somebody in there? And so as a test, it was actually a test. And the test was the reverse. It was the test for a Sith testing his young kid to see if they had the guts to go in there and actually kill somebody. So the ghost wasn't really a ghost. It was a real person. So that was there from the beginning. So then we built around that. So we came up with like, who Dal might be. I was still thinking of this kid who might, and also that nobody knows who Jedi or Sith are. This is some remote place. They're not aware of it. And then we started thinking about what it's like. Me and Will both grew up in countryside, and our adventure was basically just going up the fields, you know, going into the countryside. So the idea of kids getting away, and Stand By Me, it definitely was tonally an interesting, it was interesting to us. We both all love Stand By Me. We thought of that as kind of a touchstone, then like kids going off on a kind of last hurrah to see something scary or spooky, you know. Also for me, it was, I could really get into that. It's funny, as you start writing, the characters you come up with start to tell you the story. That's what I loved about it. and what I've discovered through writing, as you kind of come up with characters and you start thinking of who they are, they tell you what's going to happen next, you know? And so for me, Dal was like, when I was 16, I got to go to art college in Belfast, which I know your father is from, Jake, is that right? We just were talking about.
That is so right, yeah.
I went to University of Ulster in Belfast and did art. And I felt very lucky to get in there. And I knew where I was going before I did my Leaving Cert, or what you would do as your A-levels. I kind of knew I was in. All I had to do was pass my exams. So I felt quite special. I was reluctant to tell my mates I had this ticket out of town, which I grew up in a lovely town called Boyle in Roscommon. Beautiful town. But nearly everybody wants to get out of there because there's no jobs, no particularly interesting jobs there. You need to leave. So I felt I had a golden ticket, and I didn't want to gloat my friends. Some friends had to stay behind it to repeat their exams. They didn't get into the university they wanted. So it was almost like I was keeping it a secret. And I felt, oh, Dal's maybe like that. She thinks she's got a golden ticket and she's reluctant to tell her friends. She's also reluctant because she probably knows some of them might say, oh, you shouldn't go. She doesn't know if this is a bad lady either. This is somebody who's been grooming her. This is some mother figure who's saying, I'll take you away to a better life. So she feels cheated. And then when she's at the end, when she realizes what she's done. And that was the thing. A lot of people were saying, oh, they're going to hate Dal. People are going to hate Dal because she does a terrible thing. She leaves friends. And I was sure, like, no way. They're going to understand that she's faced with a choice. And it's a split second. Do I go or do I stay? I think she chose to go. So, yeah, they were really interesting. That's where it sort of came from. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer.
No, it feels so... It feels so genuine to Star Wars for me, in the sense of when you read that original, the first Star Wars movie, as George Lucas being a kid in the middle of nowhere in California, wanting to go somewhere else, the whole thing that he explored in American Graffiti as well.
Yes.
That feels like there's a very much a link here. But what I loved about the short is that it's properly scary. It's a real little horror short, which, as Star Wars has become this sort of bigger mythos, the whole monster movie aspect of it has disappeared a little bit. So that felt, again, like you were going right back to the effect of those original films.
Yeah, I remember the moment Darth Vader in the original Star Wars uses his power for the first time in that great conference table. I just think it was always the most powerful, best scene, when you suddenly, everything goes dark and he starts, and you go, oh my God, what's going on here? What is this? So that I was like going, yeah, that's kind of the thing for me that makes it special, that it's kind of has its own reality that they did very well. Like, they rooted, and it's not like you're dropped into it, you're just dropped into this space, and it has its own logic. And the design of Star Wars was so good that everything looked quite practical, and oh yeah, I can believe there's a place like this. But they added it's almost like fantasy then as well. It's science fiction, but it almost has this fantasy element to it too, with the dark side and the Force. So yeah, that was the thing that appealed to me. And I also, obviously, they're going to see a ghost. So we started, obviously, to try, okay, I'm going to try to be really scary here. And like, I love David Lynch. So there's even a shot in that I kept thinking about from Lost Highway, where a character is looking down a dark corridor. And it's just like so beautifully done. It's just a still camera shot. And you know, when you watch a movie and you see a dark hallway and somebody walks into it and you wait for it to cut. But in David Lynch doesn't cut. He just leaves you watching the darkness, and you go, oh Jesus, what's going to happen? So I didn't quite get it exactly, because we had to cut it. There was a few shots that I had to cut a bit shorter. But so I was drawing a lot from my favorite horrors, and Jason had a few influences from I can't remember the name of this Korean ghost story one he kept bringing up. He showed me a clip of, but you know, just we were so we did want to make a feeling, but I didn't expect the audiences to really get that, to find it so scary, because obviously as you're making it, it's just like, these are just drawings, we're doing the drawings, and you're thinking about it as you're storyboarding. But and then by the time you've finished it all, it's not scary to you anymore. And so it's lovely to see the reactions of people actually genuinely creeped out, and the twist as well hitting them.
I think like the kind of midpoint in the short is like where you get the twist of the ghost coming in, and that's where the style changes, and it becomes that kind of scratchy, itchy red, and it's quite shocking after everything that's come before it. But the thing that I imagine must have been so exciting, and that I thought was so beautifully rendered in a utterly terrifying way, was a cartoon saloon version of a lightsaber.
Yeah, like, that was fun to do. Like, Almu Redondo was the art director. Now, she's amazing. And she full credit to her for visually how all that looks. Now, I was a big Ralph Steadman fan. So I really wanted, I mean, the thing we tried to do here that we haven't done before is try to get a sort of pen and ink brush look in the cleanup and everything. The characters are quite roughly cleaned up, as in, like, obviously in Wolfwalkers, we had a very rough pencil style to demote, like, oh, in the forest, it's free and easy and it's loose. But here, I wanted to lean into, I was an illustrator who did editorial cartoons in the past I tried to be quite like, I was big influenced by Ralph Steadman and Pat Oliphant and people like that, with that pen and ink style and brushing style. And so I wanted to bring that into the cleanup. And then when you're in the cave, you literally try to make the cave. It's like a dark energy that is literally like thick ink, that it's like it's creeping with ink, and then just use that. So, and then with the lightsaber, you can do the same. It's just like splatters of ink, basically. So literally, that's all it is. Alma was just splattering ink and then we're just changing the frames in between it and crackling it. And actually, it's actually, the sound engineers had a great time with it because this is nice and crackly. The guys in Lucas Sky Sound, it's Kylo Ren's lightsaber twisted. So it's actually, the bass sound is Kylo Ren's, he said, and it's screwed up. Yeah, which is fun. But I wanted, and you know, what is wonderful about 2D animation is, you know, you can go mad like that. You can be as expressive as you like. I mean, I think, you know, good movies are a visual roller coaster. And I think, you know, good directors in the past, which we've all learned from, and particularly a guy who teaches about it, Bruce Block, how, like, once you have your script is one thing, but subconsciously, when you're watching a good movie, they're taking you on a visual ride as well. Like, they're taking you on, like, a subconscious, like, if you look at The Shining, when you see one point perspective, you wonder, why am I feeling uneasy here when there's one point perspective, whereas everything else before might have been parallel. It's because he set up that when I turn to one point perspective, you're going to freak out and you won't know why. And so we've always tried to do that. And so, like, when you change dramatically from, like, this is normal, you know, the way the cinematography is done, the way your backgrounds are done, it might be cam, parallel lines, you might say, when there's parallel lines and soft colors and certain colors, audience knows they feel safe. But when you change it, the audience, without really knowing it, will start to feel uneasy. So I think that's kind of the job of the director, is to take what's in the story and then add the extra bit, the subconscious visual bit, to people. And that's what we love about animation, because you've freedom to do whatever you like there, really. Yeah.
And after answering the phone really for 25 years, it was nice to actually finally be able to do that, I guess.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah. Oh, but I mean, I inherited, like, such an amazing crew, most of them from Wolfwalkers. So, I mean, they were teaching me how to do stuff. You know, I just had to keep the tonally, the story correct, and just stay on track with the story so that we don't lose the beats and we don't forget where we're going, you know, story-wise. I always remind people to come back to it, or... and really understand the character for the animators of Dahl and others. And then, but Almu and her team, Almu Redondo, who's the art director, and Fede did the character design. They were really, Almu was really showing me what we can do, how we can push the art direction as well, even more. Like, she was amazing.
Yeah, and talking about that tone and the design and everything, you have that tricky final twist to pull, which the test of strength is killing this creature, but then also the space wizard whisking the character away isn't a Jedi, it's a Sith, but you're still presenting them as this awe-inspiring being, being from another planet that's magical. So how did you approach that then, where you needed to be awe-inspiring but also have the elements of doubt and evil in there?
Yeah, well, what we, to be absolutely honest, guys, we took inspiration from the Virgin Mary and Catholic Ireland, even with the medal and Mother Mary, you know, like we went, let's see, what if she looked like an angel? So obviously she's a Sith, because obviously the instinct we had, as instinct, was just have a character come down in black. Everybody knows Sith. Oh no, it's a Sith. I mean, they will know when her eyes change, and they will know when it's a light, red lightsaber. Okay, so they're putting two and two together. But this is a character who doesn't want people to think she's a bad person. This is like Angelica Houston played it lovely, where it's like she's quite nice and motherly, but can turn on a dime. You know, she's been manipulating Dal. So she wants to present herself as some kind of angel figure or some sort of welcoming figure, as like, you're going to want to come away with me. But it's an old trick. It's all, she's just fooling. So we did draw a little bit on Catholic iconography, I guess. Even with the medal, you know, the medal that Dal speaks to, we wanted people to think, oh, she's just praying to this medallion. Maybe she's got like a holy medal type thing, which if you're a Catholic anywhere around the world at my age, they were a thing, you know, holy medals, and, you know, people have, and they usually depicted the Virgin Mary on them, or, and they're little tokens for praying, your grandmother would give you to keep you safe or something. So that was, we drew on that a little bit too, and that kind of subverted people's expectations then. So it was nice to have that twist that, no, wait, no, it just speaks back. It talks back. And so has she been talking to this person? How long has she been talking to this person? Yeah. So it's funny, we were lucky because we kind of knew what our ending was before we began. So we were always sort of going to that ending, figuring out what's the best way to get us to that ending. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, having been on the receiving end of a Irish Catholic grandmother giving me one of those medals, I loved it. I mean, with so many of your films, like, it's fascinating, the exploration of faith in lots of different ways, whether that's in Kells or Wolfwalkers. But here, I love that, because this could be a story of faith for anyone that doesn't have to be attached to Star Wars at all, mm-hmm. and you could get something out of it. And I do love how quickly and simply you as a studio even are able to explore these kind of richer depths of something that could just be surface level.
Mm. Yeah. It's kind of, I'm a raging atheist. So I kind of enjoy doing it too. You know, poking into religious stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, so moving away from Catholicism, let's go back to 1999. We've actually had Tom on the pod, we've had Nora on the pod, we haven't had yourself on the pod until now. So going back to that time period, what were your hopes, dreams for Cartoon Saloon when you were founded?
I think when myself and Tom started working together, we didn't know each other particularly well, actually. We met each other at a party, or I think I had some sketchbook or a collection of drawings. After I was kind of a bit... I was like 5 years older than Tom. So I'd been through University of Ulster in Belfast Art College, and I'd done some illustrations. So I did a little bit of a portfolio. And I think Nora's husband, Michael, was in my class in animation. Tom was a year ahead. And they shared, he brought it home to show some. It was great because Tom was quite impressed with my cartoons. And then I got very impressed with his animation. He had a jumping cow. He had a cow jumping a skipping rope, I remember noticing. But Tom, you know, had a kid, his son Ben at that time, so he really needed to earn some money. I needed to too. So we sort of met and said, I says, my brother-in-law has a job doing CD-ROMs, and would you like to help me out? I was afraid it was going to be too big, and Tom says, no, just sure, we're surrounded by animators. So in a way, we started like that, just to get us through college, doing jobs on the side. So I would do a few illustrations for the CD-ROM, Tom would do the animation bits, we'd bring in people like Nora and Michael and her husband to do some animation and colouring, and a few friends from college. And then when we left, Tom actually repeated, this is how he really wanted to be a good animator. He kind of repeated his year because he wasn't happy enough with, he passed well, but he wanted to do his final year film again. And then we got to know each other even more then. And then we moved to Kilkenny after we all finished, because there was free space here in a studio space in Young Irish Filmmakers to sort of continue. And Tom and Aidan Hart, another friend of his from Kilkenny that was working with us from college as well, had the idea for The Secret of Kells, which was called Rebel at the time. Mm-hmm. So he says, let's give it a go and see if we can kind of, we got some money together from a grant here. It was like a kind of training grant that we turned into like £100 a week for us, each person, to contribute. And we topped that up with flashcards, and back in the internet boom that was back in the early 2000s, the original internet boom, when there was the e-cards being sent around, you know, you'd email a birthday card to somebody, we were doing those mm-hmm. kind of things for people, and supplementing us doing a trailer, and then Nora did a short film. So it just kind of kept growing, and we realized, God, we really need to understand how people actually get money from films. Like, you can only get so much from Ireland, and animated films cost a lot of money. And I remember somebody telling me, look, it's going to take you at least 7 years to get your film made. It's going to be that long. You're trying to fund it, the amount of production, and trying to get... So he says, well, we'll start now. So just literally started going off to the markets like Cannes and MIPCOM and just diving in at the deep end and figuring out. The best education really was keeping showing up at the markets and meeting people in the bars afterwards, because you couldn't get a meeting with them during the day. You just lurk around the various hotels and just try to meet people and figure out, how do you put this together? So that's kind of what I did for those years, was trying to figure out how the co-productions work. And we just grew. It was interesting because it was all new to us, and you know, everything was, every day was, and every week was different. So that's kind of starting a business is like that, and starting a studio is just the same. You know, how do you do this?
And what were the most important lessons you learned in those years, where you went from being sort of a bunch of students or graduates working together to then being an actual company?
Well, big one that I said to people as our company grew and new people come and I'd be doing talking to people, is like putting yourself out there outside your own, like going international. You have to travel, because you're not going to raise any money sitting at home. So you have to kind of be a traveling salesman as a producer for a start. I mean, we kind of had the art down. I mean, Tom, Nora, so talented, and all the crew that we had. Well, I would also say, learning story, like, as soon as you can, like, because we're visual artists, we tend to forget that there's people out there working on every day they write. So also teaming up with people who do it for a long time, the likes of Will and other writers we've worked with, and then learning from them and trying to learn yourself how to tell a story, because their muscles are trained in it. And you know, you can train yourself too. Don't be afraid of stories, because sometimes animators and artists are afraid to get into, they just want to draw all the time, and they'll draw, and you can tell a brilliant story visually as well, but understanding story structure and really getting into the doing it a lot, writing a lot as well, to help you understand story, is because it is the most important thing, because in something being successful is really being able to tell a story cleanly and well. It takes a long time. It's the hardest thing. It's the hardest thing to do, is get the script right. And once you have a script that you're happy with, it's so confidence building, because then you're just plussing it and plussing it with the art you know how to do really well. So, you know, so and traveling and figuring out, the best way to learn is by going meeting other producers who are doing it. We met up with Didier Brunner, who had just was in the middle of Triplets of Belleville. I literally met him on the bus on the way to Cartoon Movie, where we were going to pitch Secret of Kells. He was talking to a guy called Colin Rose, who was BBC North. He was funding Belleville Rendezvous. And I overheard them talking. I didn't know who they were. I'd never been here before. I hadn't met the sort of animation community like this before. And the nice thing is, you're all shipped over in a plane and you get the same coach to the hotel, and then people are pitching their movie, so it's a great mixer. And I just literally tweaked my little business card through. I heard them talking about needing a studio for all these cyclists. They were struggling getting the animation done for these cyclists that's on Belleville Rendezvous. And he was like, looked at me sideways, and I says, oh, and we're pitching a movie, will you come? And he came, and like immediately afterwards he says, I really like your film, I'd like to co-produce it from France, let's have lunch. And I had no idea who he was. And the organizer of the event says, you know, that guy is really important in the animation industry at the moment. And I had seen La Ville Madame et les Pigeons, The Old Lady and the Pigeons. And it was one of my favorite shorts. And when I found out he produced that, I said, okay, he's the man for us. So it was just teaming up with somebody who'd done it before. They understand budgets. And then he brought in Vivian van Vleteren from Belgium. So it became a Belgian, French, Irish co-production. And I also got help from a lawyer here in Ireland who'd done it before. He worked for free until we got our budget. A couple of people like that did. We showed them a trailer. The trailer that we did was impressive enough that people went, okay, I'll take a chance. I'll work with you to help you. And when you get your budget, you can pay us. So they had their money waiting. If we got the budget and they helped us get the budget, they would get paid. So, I mean, and then the other big lesson was... to have things in the pipeline coming down the track, Don't just, because what we did was we thought we were great. We got Secret of Cows into production. We got Skunk Fu into production. It was like great. We did success at Curtain Firm. We had, all of a sudden we went from like 15 people to like 75 in the space of about a month or a month or two to do two big productions right beside each other. And then when we finished them, it was like a black hole. We were back to square one again. We'd nothing lined up. We were back doing commercials and shorts and we're like, oh, and it was a difficult time. Even though we got an Oscar nomination, we were like having a meeting at the time about, Jesus, what are we going to do? We were trying to get loans from our parents and stuff to keep some crew and while we were waiting on the next thing. And then we got nominated for an Oscar, which certainly was a great relief. But it was literally, I remember in a meeting when we were worried about money and we heard a scream outside from Karen, I think, who just happened to be watching the announcements. And we thought she'd seen a mouse or something. I don't know what's wrong. And then that was a great experience. But and that didn't immediately help, though. So we still had to go, we still had to raise all the money for Song of the Sea again. It was like starting again. And from then on, I realized now we have to line up stuff. We have to have a lot of things on the slate. We need to have a few ideas on the go. And it sort of came down to like having three productions happening at different stages was the sweet spot. You know, you kind of have to have one production here. If you've only got two productions, you're in danger of having a gap between them. But if you've got three, like one starting pre-production, and when pre-production finishes, you want that pre-production team rolling into pre-production of another thing. So as we started that to click, we realized, so yeah, sometimes you're going to have to do service work to bring in that work to make sure the crew. And we always wanted crew because you train up this crew and you get to know the crew. You don't want them suddenly leaving all of a sudden. But we were in Kilkenny, which is hard enough to maintain because there's no other place for the people to go. It's easier if you're in London or LA. You can hire when you want because you're not worried about your crew suddenly disappearing anywhere. They just go to another studio for a while and then when they're finished there, they might be able to come back. Whereas we're asking a lot of our crew to move to Kilkenny and give up maybe a Dublin accommodation to come down here. That's why we started Lighthouse. When I found out that Mercury Filmworks were trying to come to Europe, I reached out to them and said, here, set up in Kilkenny. I mean, just having another studio was going to be good in town. And then they it turned out we wound up a co-venture and says, look, we'll help set it up. And we jointly own it now. So that sort of tries to keep a sort of talent pool in Kilkenny. You know? Sorry, that's another long answer.
No, that covers so much because it was, I remember when we did the miniseries, it was so fascinating reading about the studio simultaneously having like a BAFTA TV award for Skunk, a nomination for Skunk Fu, Oscar nomination for Secret of Kells, but then a black hole, as you just described. Mm. So I suppose, was there a point then when you cracked it, you cracked that three productions at one time plan, and then you realised that it was a real grown-up studio you had rather than working project.
One of the biggest turning points was hiring Jerry Sheeran as our managing director. So when we were thinking, okay, we need to come up with a strategy, we'd help from John Phelan, a business consultant here, to help us come up with a six-year strategy so we wouldn't get into that situation again. And we realised, okay, we're going to have to do a certain level of service work. We're going to have to chase that. And let's get a managing director. Because money worries us. We worry about money. And sometimes we made decisions which are bad that stop us developing the next thing because, oh, we have to take that job. We have to take that job. Because we were constantly worried about money after that black hole. We needed to always bring in cash. And we remembered, I remember early on, myself and Tom visiting Jerry Sheeran, who ran a studio called Terraglyph. And he worked in Sullivan Bluth as a production manager and accountant person in there. And he was a child. And I remember going into his office when we first met him. Before we went to Cartoon Movie, he was the one who advised we go there and to MIPCOM. He was great. And he just budgets and schedules around him and money. He was an accountant. He was a chartered accountant, but he had good taste in films. And we walked out of the meeting going, oh, geez, I wish we had a Jerry. So then we says, I wonder what he's doing now. So we were able to hire Jerry, but we knew we could hire him. When we got the finance together for Song of the Sea, which we put together through another quote, and then we had that budget and we says, okay, let's hire Jerry now. And then he says, and what was brilliant was Jerry took out all the second guessing from us. He was able to go, no, we're all right for 6 months. We don't need to do that commercial. Just focus on the next project and let's line them up. So he helped. He really helped us feel more comfortable with the decisions we were really instinctively wanting to make. And not worry so much about the money and help make sure the company just structurally was set up a bit better. And then Catherine Roycroft, who started working for us as a studio assistant, just became the best chief operating officer and just helped manage all that. So myself, Noor and Tom were allowed focus on development and what happens next. And that was a great relief. And our company just grew way better after that, or just got steady way better after that, I'd say. It still is always going to have its ups and downs, where we're going to have gaps and we might lose people and then bring them back. And it's really hard because the industry changes, as it has gone through quite a flux right now, what with Warner Brothers, and there's a lot of people struggling at the moment, studios struggling. We're quite happy that we're struggling to raise the money for our next feature, but we're nearly there. And and we've got a lineup of stuff we're going to do, so we're happy about that. But it's always tough. Yeah,
it feels like we've got a few kind of significant releases that have just come in quick succession between My Father's Dragon and Visions, and then we're Puffin Rock in a month or two here as well.
Yeah.
And so then is it then a little quiet time and then?
Yes, there'll be a gap before Julian. Yeah. We're starting pre-production on Julian, based on the book Julian is a Mermaid. We're still financing it. We feel we're nearly there, but it's back to good old-fashioned co-production, European co-production. The budget is quite lower, and it gives you that freedom. We finally cracked the script, which has taken us a long time. We're really happy with the script now, but that took a while. And so that's a project we're doing with David Yates of Harry Potter fame, the director, and he's got a company called Witchwood, and they'd be great. They actually came to us with it. And Louise Bagnell was a big fan of the book, so she put her hand up, and we were waiting for something for somebody like Louise to do. So that's on the way. And Puffin Rock is out this summer, and then I'm going to be doing a film I can't talk about right now. Tom has another film he has on the books, and Nora is developing a lot of stuff that she's instigating, whereas she's adapted books before. Her next project is probably going to something that she's created herself, and we're focusing a lot on what the next slate is, which is very focused on what we've done in the past as well as new stuff. So we're excited about that, but it'll be an adjustment because we've Silly Sundays coming out, which is a TV series for Warners, which is great, and a project coming out soon, another with a big streamer, like a 20 half hours, which I can't say anything about yet, I don't think, because it's not announced, but that's a fairly major one. It's like 20 half hours, which is also approaching its launch. So that's been like a very big time. It's been a very busy few years, but almost too much. Where we've realized it's, you can almost do too much and have too many people, where it things start to run away with it, like with themselves. So now we're trying to be a bit more focused in the next few projects, but probably going to try to do less. And really strategically stagger them.
You mentioned at that point where that management came in to look after the running of the studio, so that the creatives can invest in the creative work, freeing up you and Tom and Nora to develop. Of course, we've got our presumptions of Tom and Nora as creative personalities through their films, but how would you characterize them, the two of them, as directors and creators?
Oh, they're both quite different, but very similar, because they both work together. We've grown up together. They've grown up together as directors. Nora's very editorial. She loves editing. And that's what helped Tom when he... Nora's very focused on story. She's great on story. So she loves sitting in front of an edit and doing... And she'll do the voices and all the things. Tom is very visual. He likes doing the character designs, and he wants to get straight into how something looks, which is great. So he'll work on a story outline with somebody like Will, but then he'll be immediately drawing what it looks like and working with people and already for his next film so much is advanced just working with people. And so where Nora is very focused on story, so that they've always complemented each other. So now, like, the three of us talk about everything we're doing together, so we try to take the best bits out of everybody. Tom gave me great advice on Screecher's Reach on some of the shots and some of the visual storytelling there. And I used to focus big time on the music and the sound. The North's first short film, I did the sound design with a guy here locally and worked with the composer. And I really love that aspect of it, the post-production and the scripting. But so we're trying to complement each other as best as possible. What else? We've bounced and learned off each other, really. And now we're learning a lot from the crews that we've worked with over the years. Like, we're learning from them. We're all great filmmakers themselves, and they're influencing what we're doing. So they're quite similar, but also approach films differently too.
We started the podcast about Studio Ghibli and their history, and of course that's a studio founded by with animators at the center, two directors at the center. But then when we covered Cartoon Saloon, there was this distinction where Ghibli very much struggled at letting the reins loose a bit and bringing up younger talent, where it feels like Cartoon Saloon really does support younger talent rising through the ranks. And I suppose, how, from your point of view of CEO producer, how do you foster new talent to give them that opportunity?
What I was going to say, like, it is really hard to direct. Like, it is really challenging. There is a certain personality that can do it, and it's just identifying that. And we've tried things and it's been hard on Tom. We've all learned the hard way too, and Tom and Norv learned the hard way how to do it. But I mean, directing is really about, I think people forget that part of it is management. It's being a manager. I mean, you're also a storyteller and you're trying to guide a team, but you're also there to, like a good manager, make sure what the crew gets what they need to do their job well. And sometimes you can be a little, I knew it myself, where I was, maybe you can be self-conscious and be worried about being caught out somehow as a director and be a bit guarded about what. But the experience as a director that I've had is that if you basically answer all the questions your crew are asking as much as possible, because they really know what job they're doing and you can give them what they need, that's the best way you can go about it, and stick to what you're doing with the story and keep the story and tone on track. But that's the hard part to try to get into people, is that it's a managerial position and a leadership position as well as a very creative position, you know. And Nora and Tom do that really, really well, and other directors in here do that really, really well. And that's the thing that you have to watch out for, is that it's like it is very much like you're managing a team of people and giving them what they need to do their job the best they can do it, you know. So it's a bit like that. But we are realizing as well that it is really hard to do, and sometimes we've had to dive in and help others, and it's kind of made us go like, well, we've also got a bit selfish as well, that because the three of us want to keep doing it, we are going to keep doing it ourselves and then bring up people alongside and see where we can fit in other things a lot at the same time. But we're always going to be, if we're going to do that, we're always going to be a producer with that director as well. As long as we can do that, we'll be confident about moving forward.
Well, Michael, you mentioned that the G word, and that is the name of this podcast as well. And Paul, we haven't actually. So are you a Ghibli guy?
I love Totoro. It's big. It's on repeat here in our house with our kids, and it is funny though. I did meet him once. Tom Totoro is a massive fan. I met him once really by accident, because I was at Annecy and I met a reporter there, a journalist there who works in Japan, and I says, I'm taking a trip. I was going to a wedding in Hawaii via Bali to another friend's wedding from Boyle, County Roscommon, where I'm from. Went to his wedding. This was my first big, it all became a kind of round the world trip. My first longest holiday in a long time. I went to two weddings, one in Hawaii, one in Bali. But on the way, I stopped in Tokyo. And I just happened to say this to a guy. He says, I'd love to visit Ghibli. And he says, I know the producer there. I can't remember what this, one of the producers there. And he says, I'll email him. I'll get him and he'll show you around. So I went and we chatted. And actually at the time I was thinking, I wonder, could they help us get Secret of Kells distributed in Japan? And we talked about it a little bit. They were curious because they loved the look of it. I just showed them some work, the producer there. And they says, I'll give you a tour around the studio. And he says, but you won't get to meet Mr. Miyazaki. He's really, really busy. He's in the middle of, he was in the middle of Ponyo, in fact. So I didn't expect that. I was just being shown around. It was so funny. Their schedules are entirely different to ours. Their schedules go vertically and ours go horizontally. And I thought that was funny. And I smiled at the producer. I says, oh, so how's it going on the schedule? And he just turned around to me and he just laughed. Because, you know, it was not going according to schedule. I says, oh, that's great. It's a lovely looking schedule. And he turned around and I says, how's it going? He says, you know. And he laughed. And we had that exchange of producers going, yeah, yeah, nothing goes according to plan. And but then I happened to walk around and there he was in his apron. And he went, oh, and he wanted to come over and I shook his hand and said hello. And then another time, me and Tom met him in at the governor's ball, the Academy Governor's Ball, where they awarded him an Oscar, you know, the one of those governor's Oscars. And we got a ticket there. We were over there, I think, because it was a few weeks before maybe Song of the Sea was nominated, perhaps. So we happened to be in town and our agent who was working with us at the time, he got us some tickets. Here, do you want to go to the governor's ball? And we plucked up the courage. We saw him there at a table with the Pixar people and we says, we kept plugging up, how will we say hello? Tom was mad to meet him. So I had to do my producer duties here and try to get Tom over to him. But basically he's a smoker. So I smoked and Tom had a cigarette for the first time because we went out and had a cigarette outside the back door, the exit with all the Japanese. And we met him and had a cigarette with him. Just sort of basically just saying hello. So that was, there's my our little nice fun. We have a nice selfie with him, actually, from that time. So, we were obviously big fans because he was very much a kind of director who draws first. He writes his stories like one scene at a time, which I find bananas, but amazing at the same time. But very difficult for me to do that. I have to feel comfortable with the whole story being locked, kind of. And knowing where I'm going, and then I can experiment with visually, I think. My experience, anyway. And Tom's kind of similar, but Tom might have been more like Miyazaki, that he wants to get the drones going, which is great, because then you hang these great visual beats onto a story as well. So there's multiple ways of working. I think I'm more comfortable having it solid on paper. And at the same time, during the treatment, coming up with ideas and drawing and listening to music and thinking, oh, that'd be an amazing idea. And then you kind of force that idea into the story as well. You say, I want this moment in the film, so I'm going to squeeze it in here anyway. So, and you make it work around that. But he's very inspirational about how he works. But yeah, they haven't quite successfully handed the reins over to anybody. But I know that's hard. Mm-hmm. That's just hard to do because it is hard. And directing an animated film is very difficult. Yeah, it's hard.
Do you think?
Yeah. It's not that difficult. I think if you have a good team and you let them help you, basically, if you let them help you, it's a great experience. Yeah.
And do you think if you've got a Mount Rushmore of animated works, are you putting Totoro on that?
Yes, I would. I love. I'm just blanking on the name. The great anime that you guys just showed, you've just done a book on it. Akira, what am I saying? I was about to call it anime. Akira, I saw as a kid, which just blew my mind because it was just like, oh my God, animation can do this. It's like all drawn. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was like a comic book to me. And I that just blew my mind. I think I saw that in Channel 4 when I was about 10. I can't remember when it came out, probably after that. But the anime or Akira would be one of my favorites, and an Iron Giant, things like that.
Yeah, and
the Thief and the Cobbler obviously was something we watched over and over and over again. Like whatever pirated copy Tom had on VHS, that wasn't the musical version that Disney sort of butchered at the time, but the stuff that there was a copy going around on VHS that was all the original stuff from him and the line tests and the rest of it that was like just line tests. Still somebody had put something like that together, so yeah, I remember watching that.
Yeah, there's a There's a cut of that that's doing the rounds called like the recobbled cut or something.
Yeah.
Meant to be as close to what...
Yeah, actually, I think that came after the one we have, and I think that was released. And I think we went to watch one of those in London. I think somebody... Yeah, there was somebody played it in London. I think the layout guy, I can't remember his name now, but there was a layout man who was a genius on that. Who, like, you know, the opening shot when you come in from like into the city was like a giant layout. I think Tom was chatting to him when he got to see it. He was describing all that. Yeah, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
I love hearing about your like VHS escapades, because I think when we had Tom and Ross on the podcast, they talked about going frame by frame through Princess Mononoke on a VHS in the 90s. I'm sure on a version of it that had been procured from nefarious means.
Yeah. Some copy of a copy discovered. That was going around the school, you know. Yeah. And doing the shuffle, the VHS shuffle. Yeah, because me and Tom used to live in the same house when we moved down to Kilkenny, and we did a lot of that, watching those movies, VHS is over. But I was also trying to bring them into stuff that I learned from Belfast. I used to watch movies 3 times a week in the QFT, because I had friends who worked there, so I used to get into the QFT for free. But I was watching stuff like Man Bites Dogs and Reservoir Dogs, and Paris, Texas was my favourite film ever. So I was trying to get... I was introducing the lads to like more live action stuff as best I could as well, like to help influence, you know, showing different types of tone, and that maybe a film can be slower and paced a bit, you know, but so we all were trying to influence each other with music tastes and film tastes. And yeah, it was good. It's like what happens in college, but we just extended it beyond college.
What was the music tastes going around?
I wrote my thesis in university based a lot on film music. I did my thesis on Brian Eno and David Byrne, and my thesis was on music for figurative painting about Brian Eno, and I lost it now, I can't remember it, but it was such an arsey title. But it was really interesting to me, because I realizing that he was a visual artist and then turned to music, the same like many people, like David Byrne as well. And Talking Heads, so I was a big fan of, but I started getting into that ambient music stuff and how music and then how soundtracks influence films, and then I did a lot of writing on architecture and science fiction film that I think I remember. I started getting into Blade Runner, and that's my interest in science fiction, really got into like how do they design the architecture of science fiction, like what makes it claustrophobic, and you know, why did they design things the way they did. So I was always I was always trying to bring in the temp soundtrack to the stuff we were doing to see how it might suit. I still love that when at the moment now for a project I'm doing, I'm just listening to a lot of music and walking around, and it can help spur, if you're trying to figure out how you're going to tell part of the story, music is a great influence on how you might rhythmically do it and emotionally do it, and even if you put like the temp soundtrack down and then you can animate to that or beat it out, at least then when you're doing the original music it can go to the same tempo. I think music is like 50% of the experience, you know. It's like it's definitely, you know, 50% of the experience of watching a film for me is the music.
Yeah, but you're very much in with Michael and I's taste there. I think we were debating the best ambient Eno album a couple of weeks ago, and I'd recently got married a couple of weeks back and started my wedding speech with David Byrne lyrics. So you're comfortable with us.
Was it This Must Be the Place? Because it's probably his only love song he ever wrote, This Must Be the Place. We had it at our wedding.
Yeah, you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. That's an easy opener for a speech.
Yeah. I got married last year myself. Yeah.
Well, I think all of this feeds into the final question that we ask all our guests. And sorry to spring this on you, Paul. I don't know if you've listened to any of our interview episodes before. But, of course, we started this podcast as a Ghibli-focused podcast. And that's because I said to Jake, who hadn't seen any of the films before, you have to watch them as a body of work. And what, you know, the films and the story they tell as a production story, a studio story. And when we came to the end of Ghibli, we then looked for other filmmakers and studios that also had a defining aesthetic or point of view or worldview. That's where it took us to Cartoon Saloon, to the films of Satoshi Kon, Mamoru Hosoda as well. And so we like to ask our guests, where could we go in the future? Is there a filmmaker that you think has a body of work we could go through film by film? It doesn't have to be animation.
Well, I love Jim Jarmusch, obviously, but he's not animation, but I'm just a big fan of Jim Jarmusch. Like, and Wim Wenders were my favourite. Paris, Texas, Jim Jarmusch. They were kind of the pacing of a film as a student growing up that I loved. Particularly Dead Man and Ghost Dog by Jim Jarmusch are awesome. Just with the way he uses music again. Ghost Dog is amazing by Reza. The guy from Wu-Tang Clan does an amazing soundtrack for that. But then there's a studio, if you're really interested in looking at a new studio, there's a French studio called La Cachette, which are very new. They did one of the Visions, the one The Dancer. Oh, I'm forgetting the title.
The sort of French Resistance type one.
That one I love. Their animation is amazing. Their animation, to me, they do action animation so beautifully. A bit like Ghibli, in a way. If you look at, they're doing stuff for Genndy Tartakovsky now. You know that the show, the series he did with the dinosaur and the caveman.
Primal, amazing.
Primal. Yeah, their animation is wonderful, I think. Like I said, I think there's studio to watch out for, I think, now as well. But yeah, filmmakers, yeah, I always have to go back to my Paris, Texas. It's one of my favourite films.
Didn't you just do an intro to that, Michael?
I just did an introduction to it in Brighton. There was a screening of it. They did a big re-release of all of Wim Wenders' films late last year, and it was great to watch Paris, Texas with like 200 people sold out on a Sunday morning on the big screen.
I don't know what it is about that film, but it's an example where, like, that film was nothing without that soundtrack, that Ry Cooder soundtrack either. It's like 50% more, but also it's just this beautiful redemption story. I just love this idea that, you know, it all happens towards the end. You figure out what it's all been leading up to. I don't know. It's something about the odd pace of that. And it's just beautiful to watch. And Dead Man as well, in a way, which is not him, obviously. It's Jim Jarmusch. It's not Wim Wenders. But in a similar way, that Neil Young soundtrack is just awesome. It's part of it, the character of it. And it's like going on a camping trip or something. And it's a very philosophical camping trip or something. Yeah. And he kind of is interesting. He uses the same tropes. He always has three guys who act like kind of the comedic thing. Like in Down by Law is a wonderful film by Jim Jarmusch. And a total indie filmmaker, which I respect. Same as Wim Wenders. They were like, they made films without any compromise to any influence outside, you know, raising the money themselves and working with teams and just doing it. Yeah.
And they both have new projects that have just premiered in Cannes. So well to
have they? I wasn't even aware. So, of that. Both.
So
both
Wim Wenders.
There's two Wim Wenders.
So Wim Wenders did a documentary, but also his first fiction feature in a long while premiered. And Jim Jarmusch has rescored a bunch of Man Ray short films with his band.
Oh.
So I imagine that's just going to be lots of glorious feedback to wash over.
I've something to look forward to. So. I am looking forward to the Scorsese film, I must say. Killers of the Flower Moon. That looks like it's going to be great as well. But I'm looking forward to those Jim Jarmusch and Wim Wenders as well.
Oh, and we're looking forward to all those projects you can't tell us much about. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a treat speaking with you. Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
And there you have it, listeners. Thank you to Paul Young for joining us today, nerding out about Star Wars, going into the business context behind the studio of Cartoon Saloon, and also giving us a great deal of independent live-action filmmakers to go and check out afterwards. Jake, how surprised were you that not only David Lynch, but Wim Wenders and Jim Jarmusch came up in that conversation?
I mean, we've got a series for years now. I cannot wait to be diving into all of those. I mean, just to spend another 90 minutes with a straight story would be lovely.
And now I come to think of it, a Brian Eno and/or David Byrne type of miniseries, not for our podcast, of course, but for a Ghibliotech type format, that'd be quite fun. That's another Talking Heads as a band, Brian Eno as a recording artist.
I mean, we could quite easily do a David Byrne directorial efforts miniseries. That wouldn't take that long if we wanted to do his films.
So that's two films, isn't it? Yeah. Is it American Utopia and True Stories?
Yeah, well, American Utopia was directed by Spike Lee. So it's one film is the True Stories.
No, he did. He did the Contemporary Colour.
Yeah.
He did do one recently. Yeah. Sorry, I was mixed up. Yeah. Well, thank you, Paul, for giving us many potential miniseries to think about. And also, straight away, I pulled out the vinyl of the Paris, Texas soundtrack. That's going to be what I'm listening to for the rest of the day. Also, always wonderful to hear from our friends at Cartoon Saloon when they talk about other animators and other designers and artists that work there. So Almu Redondo, I'd really recommend checking out their Instagram, their Twitter account, just because of the pure artistry that you can see there. As well, great to hear about Louise Bagnell having a feature potentially down the line. We loved her short, Late Afternoon. We talked about that on the podcast in the mini-series and have been keenly looking forward to whatever she does as a feature director.
And Puffin Rock as well. Like, we've just seen this morning that it's had, or at the time of recording, it's got distribution here in the UK. It's going to be out here in July, perfect for the summer holidays. And that there's going to be distribution globally. It's so great to have that out there. Paul said just before we started recording that has been such a long gestating project. It's not just like a quick turnaround, like cash in on a TV show. They started work on the Puffin Rock film 6 years ago. Like, this is like real labor of love. Well, we'll have to add that to the Cartoon Saloon-iverse, as well as catching up with My Father's Dragon one too. Like, there's the Saloon-iverse keeps expanding faster than we can keep up with it.
Does that make Puffin Rock the Princess Kaguya of Cartoon Saloon? What were you doing 6 years ago, Jake? I mean, that's something to think about.
The podcast didn't even exist. Yeah.
We didn't even exist back then.
No.
We were grown in a lab in 2018. But yes, we should take another voyage into the Cartoon Saloon-iverse very soon. And maybe over on the Library Cafe, we can talk about the rest of Star Wars Visions. There are some really good shorts within that second series in particular, including one by Aardman, which is well worth looking for. But in the meantime, you can follow us on socials to see what we're up to. We have a couple of books out on the other side of summer. One, A Guide to Korean Cinema. Also, A Guide to Studio Ghibli for younger readers. You can find out more about that at GhibliAttack on Twitter, or ghibliattack.pod on Instagram. And you can stalk us personally. Jake is on Twitter at JakeHCunningham and on Instagram at Jake.H.Cunningham.
And Michael's on Twitter at MichaelJLeader and Instagram at Michael.Leader.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.